The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Hi, I hope you've been enjoying your Clare Byrne Show podcast this week. If you've liked what you've heard here, you might also be interested in the News Talk Daily podcast with Ciara Doherty. They've covered some really interesting stuff recently, with everything from Ozempic breasts and the dark side of weight loss medications to why the 90s are so back. But my favourite piece this week was their discussion of the review into the Katie Simpson murder investigation, featuring Katie's aunt, Paula Mullen, and Alison Morris from the Belfast Telegraph. Take a listen.
In August 2020, 21-year-old Katie Simpson was rushed to hospital in Derry with severe injuries. The explanation given at the time was that she had tried to take her own life. But almost immediately, there were questions. Quiet ones at first, from those who knew her, from people who felt that something about the story didn't sit right. What followed was a case that would unravel layer by layer, exposing inconsistencies, missed opportunities, and one that would become the focus of a murder investigation and ultimately a damning review of the PSNI's handling of the case. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And Jonathan Creswell was the partner of Katie's eldest sister, Christina. He drove her to the hospital, concocting a story to shield his heinous crimes. As a 21-year-old, he'd been convicted and jailed for serious assaults on his ex-girlfriend, Abigail Lyle. Despite this, the authorities bought his version of events. Now a really stark report has found officers failed to identify inconsistencies in Jonathan Creswell's account, neglected to preserve vital evidence, overlooked forensic scenes and opportunities, and dismissed key witness statements. The report also found that 37 people, both female and male, have come forward to say they were abused by Jonathan Creswell. And just to say, this podcast will be discussing murder, rape and coercive control and won't be suitable for younger ears and may be triggering to some listeners. Well, Alison Morris is crime correspondent with the Belfast Telegraph and has been covering this story for years. Alison, I think to really understand just how serious the findings are of this review, we have to go back and we have to understand who Jonathan Creswell was and who Katie Simpson was and how they knew each other. What can you tell us?
So Katie was 21 at the time of her death. She was from County Armagh and she was a very accomplished horse rider. She had been a show jumper and was obsessed with horses, and that was her, what she worked as after school, and that was what she had been involved in all her life. And Creswell was a horse trainer. He was much older and he was at the time of her death the partner of her sister Christina, and had children with Christina, but had been well known in that equestrian world and that equestrian set for a very long time. He was someone who got results in terms of the people he trained, and because of that, he seems to have been able to get away with all sorts of horrendously abusive and coercive behaviour without ever being held to account. And this was prior to the death of Katie.
Let's go back to August 3rd, 2020. And Katie Simpson is living in Derry and she's brought to Alton Galvin Hospital in Derry in a critical condition by Jonathan Creswell. What story did he tell medics about what had happened to her?
So initially he claimed that he had gone to leave his children off at his parents' house, and when he came back that Katie had been trying to take her own life, that he had cut her down. He had put her into Katie's car, into the passenger seat of Katie's car. He then made a 999 call, but he started driving, which I suppose would have been red flag number one, rather than wait for the ambulance. He started driving in the direction of Alton Galvin Hospital, and it's part during this journey he met the ambulance. He stopped, and also then police attended the scene. So he tells the same story time and time again. He says that he had come home, that Katie had been trying to take her own life, that he had cut her down and that he had put her in the car and was trying to rush her to hospital. But even from that very, very initial interaction with the police, that was when, I suppose, the failings, if we were to ignore all the previous failures to spot that Katie was being abused, that was when, I suppose, the failings really started. So rather than detain him at the scene and seize the car as a crime scene, police told him to follow behind the ambulance to the hospital. He didn't do that. He went back to the house, he changed his clothes and he showered, and he gave his clothes to one of the three women who was later convicted of assisting offenders to take away and wash And then he arrived back at the hospital in a completely different outfit, and the officers failed to question, first of all, why he hadn't followed behind the ambulance, and also why he was wearing different clothes than he had been when they had met with him earlier in the day.
And Katie never regained consciousness. She died 6 days later. And despite this sort of gradual build-up of red flags that made that original suicide attempt explanation hard to sustain, it did sustain within the police and indeed within the wider equestrian community for a long period of time.
It did. You know, it wasn't until the following March that Cresswell was eventually arrested in terms of the murder of Katie. And up until that, numerous people were trying to whistleblow and were trying to raise concerns with the police, but they were dismissed. And it was very difficult then to start trying to investigate the murder at a later date, because when you talk about the failures, you know, they didn't seize her car, they didn't examine it as a crime scene, they didn't treat Cresswell himself as a potential crime scene in terms of his own clothing, which could have obviously yielded information. When Katie was taken into hospital, she was covered in bruises, her arms were bruised, her legs were bruised. When the nurse went to try and insert a catheter, they realised that she was bleeding and that her underwear was covered in blood. And yet there was no questions are raised in relation to this. Cresswell said she'd fallen from a horse the day before and that's why she was covered in bruises. Nobody checked this. Nobody went to the yard where Katie trained and worked to find out had she fallen from a horse. They just accepted his word for it. And even though the injuries weren't really consistent with a fall from a horse, nobody questioned this for the week. When the police showed up at the hospital too, the only people they spoke to was Cresswell and Christina Simpson, who was Katie's sister. They didn't speak to her parents, even though her mum was their next of kin. And when the mum was let in to see Katie, and she should have been the only person allowed in to see her, Cresswell accompanied her at all times. So at no time was the family able to speak to police privately or alone, where they may have had some concerns. And it also meant that Cresswell got to the family first and was able to put this sort of suicide story in their heads and get his narrative across before any questions were asked. Her phone wasn't seized. Her phone wasn't found until he was arrested the following year. And the report states that one of Katie's sisters had noticed that the phone was active, that Katie had left a group chat, a family group chat, about 4 months after she died, and was picking up Snapchat messages about 5 months after she died. And that was because Cresswell had the phone. She thought at the time police had the phone and this was from looking for evidence, but it wasn't, and because there was no communication. And if there was, and police had told her that they hadn't found Katie's phone, she would be able to have told them that the phone had been active during those times. There was no pictures taken of Katie's injuries. There was no rape kit done to say, even though that she showed signs of sexual assault. And it wasn't, the first pictures weren't taken until she died over a week later by the pathologist. And at that stage, obviously, a lot of the bruising would have faded and was no longer there to show the original state that she was in when she was admitted to hospital.
What do we know now, Alison, about how Katie met her death?
Katie met a really, really violent death. She had been beaten, she had been strangled, and she had been raped repeatedly. And that had been going on from the previous day. What happened was that Katie had been secretly, because Cresswell had such a control over her, she wasn't allowed to see anyone else or see other men. She had been secretly meeting a boyfriend, someone who had real affectionate love for her, and someone had seen the two of them together and told this to Cresswell. He had went and picked her up from a horse show and driven her home, stopping repeatedly along the way to rape and beat her. And this had went on until the next morning when I think he must have panicked when he realised that he had this on this occasion, and he had clearly beaten and abused Katie multiple times over the years, but on this occasion he'd went too far and she'd went to the point where she had stopped breathing and was barely alive, and that was when he phoned the ambulance. But there were injuries that were not consistent with his explanation. They weren't consistent with a fall from a horse, or with the way he said that she was trying to end her own life, and that is where they should have been picked up. One of the body-worn footage of the police when they did the first walkthrough of the house, which again wasn't treated like a crime scene, is 4 seconds long. A second clip available to when the report was being carried out is 3 seconds long and is blurry and shaky and so of no evidential value. And that in itself, I suppose, is something, you know, you imagine attending the scene where someone says they found a young woman who was in a state of undress and wearing, you know, bloodstained underwear. You'd imagine the first thing would be to go in and do a walk through the crimes, the scene that this was meant to have taken place with your body-worn camera on, and assess if it fitted with the story, and none of that was done.
So just a whole litany of failures there in those opening days after she was admitted to hospital. What was it that forced the police to look at this case again, to re-examine the case and see if death by suicide was indeed the explanation for her passing?
There was a number of people who were raising the alarm. One was actually a journalist, a court reporter, Tanya Fowles. She had reported on Cresswell's earlier conviction for a very brutal assault on his former partner, Abby Lyle. He was jailed for that. And yet, despite that, when he came back out, he was welcomed like a hero with a party by those sort of equestrian horsey set and went straight back to work again. Abby Lyle waved around nimbly and told that story. Some people who are listening to this, if they are into the world of show jumping, will recognise Abby Lyle's husband being in the last Olympics representing Ireland and is expected to represent him in the next Olympics. And she has gone on to turn her life around. But she was initially the person who told police about the brutal nature of the way that Cresswell was treating her and other women. That was completely ignored. Then there was another whistleblower who was a friend of both Katie, Christina and Cresswell at one stage, and that was a guy called Paul Lusby. He tried to report it to the ombudsman, the police ombudsman. They wouldn't accept his complaint because he wasn't a family member. He had went to a police station. They wouldn't take a statement of him, but they did take notes as he relayed to them what his concerns were. And the report found that those notes were destroyed and they were never acted on. And there was a nurse as well, and as well as one of Katie's aunts, I think, had raised concerns too. Eventually, they agreed to reopen it and they did manage to build a circumstantial case. But the fact is that a lot of the evidence was lost. And I should say that Paul Lusby, who is the sort of hero of this piece in terms of he just would refuse to give up and kept going back and trying to make ombudsman complaints, make police complaints. He also took his own life after this. He was not heeded at all. And he is another, I suppose, victim of this terrible story.
I mean, Jonathan Cresswell was eventually charged with the murder and rape of Katie Simpson. It was to go to trial. A jury was sworn in. The prosecution began to present their evidence, which I think, even though circumstantial, was fairly overwhelming. But that trial never progressed because Jonathan himself died by suicide just 24 hours after the trial began. So the family were really denied that opportunity, weren't they, to find out what had happened to their daughter and to see him face justice.
Yeah, and that was it. Katie was denied justice. You know, as you said, the prosecution opening took place, and by the next day he didn't show up in court, and when there was a check done on his house, he had taken his own life. And clearly that was a sort of, I suppose, last act of power in terms of what he could do to evade justice. But since then, we know that since Katie's death, 37 other victims involved in the equestrian world have came forward to say that they were abused by Cresswell. The youngest one of those was just 9 years old at the time of the abuse, and the eldest around 21. And, you know, police have also identified two other alleged perpetrators also in that horse training equestrian world as well, who are currently under investigation. You know, this report is damning in terms of the police in action, but it also looks at the failure of the health trust. Katie, about once a year, from she was quite young, was appearing in hospital with quite serious and ever increasingly serious injuries. And no one ever questioned them or referred her to see if she was a child at risk, which she clearly was. And also the lack of safeguarding in the equestrian world in Northern Ireland. I don't know what it's like in the South, but if you wanted to teach a kids football team or, you know, coach a Gaelic team, you would have to be access NI'd and police checked in order to be able to have access to children. None of that existed in the world that Katie was in. There was no need for any checks or balances, and that was a real failure. And also, I suppose, that the inset misogyny that existed in that world, where people like Cresswell were held up, you know, on a pedestal, and also the misogyny within the PSNI. I suppose one of the lines that jumped out at me was when the police ombudsman was investigating this and they spoke to some of the police officers who were involved in the initial investigation. One described Cresswell as a bit of a bad boy. And the other one said, oh, he's a bit of a philanderer. And, you know, the report is damning in terms of this language. They're saying such language, referring to people who is a predator, obscures the harm done by men like Cresswell. And it's denying women's experience of their abuse. And that sort of inbuilt, I suppose, misogyny is something that's quite difficult to take out of an institution like the PSNI.
I think just for News Talk Daily listeners, it is really important to go back to the case of Abby Lyle, or Abigail Lyle, as she can be known, because that is the red flag here that really should have made the police in that moment look at Cresswell differently. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and in conclusion 17 of this report, it says the failure of police to record and act on key information or check criminal records relating to Cresswell points to a systemic issue in terms of police and domestic abuse and coercive control. And without consistent documentation and risk recognition, that sort of pattern of behaviour went, I suppose, unreported. There were so many missed opportunities. And as you said, you know, people can go and they can look online. I interviewed Abby Lyle just before Christmas there because her story is so inspiring and so empowering. She escaped this man who almost killed her. He threatened to kill her. He threatened to drown her in a bath of bleach and took her to a forest where he said he was going to put her body. And she managed to get out of the coercive control and escape that and went on to ride at the Olympics, which I think is, you know, for anyone listening to this and you're in an abusive relationship and you can't get out of it, go and read Abby Lyle's story because it shows that there is life after abuse.
Mm. But what's important, I suppose, to flag, Alison, for our listeners is that she did report Jonathan Cresswell. There were a number of charges against him and he did eventually plead guilty to five of those charges. So he had a record and he had a history of domestic abuse and coercive control that the police should have been able to see in access.
They should have. And also it's worth reminding that when Jonathan Cresswell got out of prison, as I said, he was welcomed home. Do you hear he was welcome? There was a party thrown for him. Abby Lyle had to move to England to train there because she was victim shamed. She wasn't believed. And there's people within that world who still didn't believe what she was trying to tell them in relation to this. And that, I suppose, is the fact that this report just doesn't look at police failings, which are damning, but it also looks at failings in terms of the safeguarding in that world and how that world is structured and organised. And the fact that there's men, predatory men, have access to very young girls who are just horse mad, you know, and that's all they want to do. Mm. And that, I suppose, that, you know, that the desire to turn that into the living and turn it into their career is making them really vulnerable to predatory men. And also the health trust, which failed to impose safeguarding, and also which failed to flag up the fact that this young girl, a child at the time, was showing up at least once a year at A&E with really serious injuries, some facial injuries, soft tissue injuries, broken bones, and no one was being flagged up to go and see what the circumstances were that she was living in.
As you say, the findings of this report are really stark. They talk about institutional misogyny within the PSNI. How do you think they're going to respond to this, Alison?
The PSNI have released a statement and have apologised, and I know that there is a real... We have a new Chief Constable, John Boucher. He was not Chief Constable at the time when this took place, and he initiated his own report as well into some of these findings, into looking at the safeguarding. And also one of, I suppose, the things that he has put in place is the vetting and refetting of police officers, and that's something that came around to after the murder of Sir Everard. So as we know, after she was murdered by a member of the Metropolitan Police, there was a re-vetting of police officers from forces all across these islands, and that showed up some people who should not have been in any police service, and they have since been subject to disciplinary proceedings are removed. So there is attempts to try and do something about this. Kitty can never get justice, and those other girls and some boys who have came forward and reported abuse will never get justice because Cresswell's dead. But what I suppose we can do from this report is make sure it doesn't happen again, because nothing like this can be allowed to happen again. It is shocking. It is probably, and I have been a journalist for what, 26 years now. I've covered inquiries, ombudsman reports, public inquiries into deaths, misconduct, all sorts of things. And I don't think I've ever read something. It's just the very basics of police work that you imagine should just be a day one in police training college were not put in place in this case. They were just completely missed or ignored.
Well, Alison, it's an absolutely harrowing read. Thank you for taking the time, though, to bring us all of that information here on News Talk Daily. On the podcast now is Paula Mullen, an aunt of Katie Simpson, and she's joining us to reflect on the findings of that review into her niece's death and what it says about failures within the PSNI. Thank you for speaking to us here on News Talk Daily, and what I'm sure has been a difficult day for you and the whole family. When you read the review, what went through your mind, Paula? What's parts stayed with you the most?
Yeah, it was a big day. Now, a lot went through my mind today, just, you know, about Katie and all the failures, but most of all, how we can still, you know, the PSNI here can still stand by and let senior officers not take any accountability for what they've done and what they didn't do, actually. And why they were so determined to make it suicide. that was the cause of death. It just highlighted the fact that, you know, more needs done. And there is 16 recommendations. So hopefully, you know, there's going to be something changes, you know, because there's been a lot of women have went through the same, the hands of an abuser. Coercive control, a lot of that just seemed to be a lot highlighted today. And then I just was sitting thinking, you know, we have started up a Katie Trust in Katie's sort of name, and it is needed. You know, the Katie Trust now at the moment have 100 families, over 100 families needing help. Same sort of situations where their death wasn't taken serious, and the Katie Trust is helping them. So, so just a few things like that, you know, just the failures in the police and the doctors and social workers, everybody really.
I mean, you say there's these list of recommendations now and promises that there will be meaningful change within the PSNI. Are you confident, given, as you say, there's a lack of accountability, as you see it, that that can happen?
Yeah, it's hard to have confidence. Like, the senior officer's been able to retire without any accountability is something that the Justice Minister is looking at. But too late for us. But, you know, really, like, they should have been held accountable for what they done or what they didn't do.
The report talks about institutional misogyny within the PSNI. From your perspective, how did that show up in the way Katie was treated?
It did, you know, because it is so real. Like, when it comes to your own door, you know, they wouldn't listen to people, you know, that we knew her as a person, that she would never have done that. Never. Never have took her own life. Just full of life. You know, they just, I don't know, they just didn't want to take it on or what, I don't know.
There were so many missed opportunities identified in this report. Do you find yourself thinking about those what-if moments, and how do you process that as her family?
Oh, it's not easy. It's not easy, you know, because there's a lot of what ifs. You know, what if the police had listened to us at the start? What if, you know, they had done more before Katie even, you know, he would have been in jail. He wouldn't have, he would have been known as a predator, abuser. What if, you know, we never had him at the wake, in the wake house, touching her hair, you know, at the funeral, me and chief mourner. You know, them things to haunt a family.
Can you tell us a bit about Katie as a person beyond all of these headlines and what you feel as a family has been lost?
Oh, a firecracker, just unreal. So funny and so full of life, loved life and real devilment, you know, just loved, could have played with a 2-year-old as well as a 90-year-old. She's just full of devilment and play and full of life. And she was a very strong girl too. And that's what I think maybe the public, maybe, you know, we all need, even before this happened to us as a family, you'd have never thought, you know, you would never stay with a man that controls you or, but you don't know until you're in that situation. Katie, I would have said, was a very strong girl, wouldn't have talked no nonsense, but there you go. You know, it can happen to anybody.
Is that your message then to listeners today who might recognise signs of coercive control in their own lives or in someone else's life?
Yeah, that's it. Don't, I think sometimes people blame the actual victim. You know, why didn't you do this? And why didn't you speak up? And why not? Why this? That's not real life. You know, like maybe before this, I maybe would have been the same. And I thought, God, you know, I thought she would have been a strong girl. She wouldn't have went near him. But it can happen, you know, to anybody.
Do your family feel any sort of peace after this report? They feel now they can go and mourn Katie.
Yeah, I think it has. You know, full disclosure is a good thing. You know, and if, you know, the police and everybody else would do the same. Just full disclosure makes the way forward.
Paula, thanks so much for speaking to us on News Talk Daily today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for today's episode of News Talk Daily. If you've been affected by anything that we've discussed here in the podcast, you can contact the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre on 1800 778888. Until tomorrow, goodbye.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of News Talk Daily. If you did, you might want to check out the News Talk Daily podcast feed, where you'll find over 200 episodes on a whole range of topics, from politics to sport, crime and culture. Listen and subscribe for free in the Go Loud app or wherever you found this podcast.
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.